This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Many analysts believe that the ideology behind many of President Bush's policies, Iraq in particular, originate from the so-called neoconservatives in the administration. That school of thought, in turn, is traced to a professor of political philosophy at the University of Chicago named Leo Strauss. Strauss taught a controversial brand of political science. He denounced the moral relativism of the 20th century and spoke of universal truths that transcend history and time. His ideas inspired many of his students. Some went on to become teachers themselves. Others have applied his theories in government. Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz, for example, is identified as a Straussian, along with former vice presidential aide and now editor William Kristol. Yet other students of Strauss argue that Strauss himself was never overtly political and that his theories have been misconstrued by neoconservatives. 30 years after his death, Leo Strauss is blamed or credited as the architect of American empire, as the central figure in a conservative cult, or as the most influential thinker of the 20th century. Later in the program, an emotional high-stakes debate on the future of Israel begins in the Knesset on Prime Minister Sharon's disengagement plan, and your letters. But first, the controversial legacy of Leo Strauss. If you have questions about who Strauss was or about his influence in politics, give us a phone call. If you studied Strauss, tell us what you make of his ideas. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Nicholas Kissinos is a political scientist at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. He's writing a book about Leo Strauss, and he joins us now from the studios of member station WFCR in Amherst. And thanks very much for being with us.
Hi.
Before we get into Strauss's political philosophy, give us a better sense of the man himself. If I'm right, Strauss was a Jew living in Germany in the years before the Second World War and left the country in 1938.
That's pretty much right. He was born in 1899 and became an adult during the period of the Weimar period, between the interwar period, and is very much a product, I think, in a lot of ways, of the intellectual climate of that time.
Where did he study? Who did he study with?
Well, most famously, he studied with the German philosopher Edmund Husserl, and later came under some influence, although he never really sort of formally studied with Martin Heidegger. Strauss was very much involved in German-Jewish intellectual circles in questions of Zionism, in questions of German and Jewish identity in that period, and that would have been pretty much across the board in university circles then.
Well, Nicholas Kissinos, Strauss was, as you say, in many ways a product of his time. Anti-Semitism was, of course, sweeping Germany. If he argued of a world of true evil, maybe he had knowledge.
Well, not really. I mean, I don't think so. It's a little more complicated than that. The problem for Strauss, and not only Strauss, was the problem that the modern Enlightenment age posed for Jewish identity in large measure. The atomization, the individualism of the Enlightenment posed a threat to traditional inherited cultural identities, and most particularly to the cultural identity of Jews, because their identity is so much wrapped up in a revelatory religious identity. So Strauss was not the only one who found this problematic, and he developed really a theoretical orientation that was highly questioning of the value of modern values, and very much interested in seeking a kind of a solution, as it were, for the Jewish crisis in modernity.
Mm-hmm. And he studied, he kept going back through philosophers in time, Maimonides, and then back to Plato, Aristotle.
Well, his first major subject was Spinoza, of course, the first excommunicated Jew, as it were, because he looked there to see where some of the problems that were contained in Jewish identity and the problem of reason or rationalism lie. Later, he turned to Maimonides, and it was in his study of Maimonides, the medieval Jewish philosopher, that he developed the notion of esoteric and exoteric language and interpretation of texts. And that became very much a part of the Straussian legacy, and I think is a large part, in fact, of the way in which Straussians are perceived.
Well, for those of us who been some years since we've been in philosophy class. Tell us the difference between esoteric and exoteric.
Strauss developed the notion that writers such as Maimonides, writing in the periods of political repression or political order constituted by an inviolable law, developed a kind of double-edged way of writing. Let me back up a half a second. Underneath this whole notion is the idea that philosophy, what philosophy is about, is the questioning of truths, questioning of commonly held opinions. And Strauss, through his reading of Maimonides, came to the conclusion that successful philosophers like Maimonides developed this double layer of writing in which, at one level, the exoteric level, or the level directed to the outside, they would apparently be substantiating the commonly held opinion, or at least the rule of law as it existed. At the esoteric level, which one had to learn to read, they were actually at the same time developing theories and interpretations that would undermine that opinion.
So that there was a coded message, in a sense, inside?
Yes, very much a coded message. And Strauss saw this in things like obvious contradictions within a text, subjects that were briefly mentioned and then dropped. In other words, there were clues that one could pick up and follow. And the sort of more positive aspect of this is he was suggesting that in the pre-modern period, people wrote and read in a different way, and one needed to learn how they wrote and read in order to be able to understand them correctly. In other words, one had to sidestep the prejudices of the modern age, which was a prejudice of openly stated truths and clarity and transparency.
Well, can't someone like Maimonides or Aristotle, for that matter, be taken as a product of their time? I mean, he might have had coded messages because it wasn't necessarily safe to state things openly.
That's right. Now, what Strauss did was, I think, extended that to the larger claim that philosophers are almost always in this position, that the pursuit of philosophy, because it questions opinion, and that philosophy begins from opinion and then moves to a criticism of opinion, that philosophers are always necessarily in a state of tension with the societies in which they live. And Socrates became, for him, the great sort of exemplar of this. Socrates eventually, pursuing the truth, questioning everything, winds up condemned to death by the Athenian democracy for introducing false gods.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to Strauss and get back to, he left Germany and then came to first to New York and then to the University of Chicago.
Right. He was in Paris and England in 1932 on a Rockefeller Fellowship to do work on Hobbes and a book he subsequently published in 1936 in Hobbes. So he was in England when the Nazis came to power in Germany. And eventually he tried to get an academic position in Palestine and was unable to do that, and eventually came to the United States to Columbia, taught for 10 years at the University in Exile, the New School for Social Research in New York, and then moved to Chicago in 1949 and taught there until his retirement in 1963, I think it was.
And developed a view of America and American politics that fit, he thought, very well with his philosophy.
Well, he did. This is the complicated part, and this is where I think I might differ to some degree.
Now we get complicated.
I might differ with Cornel West on this. Yes, he did. He came to the United States. He started, the influential book was called Natural Right and History. And out of that book, one can read an interpretation that says that the United States was somewhat different from the European past, and that the founders adhered to a notion of natural law that was, in effect, pre-Enlightenment notion, or at least the Enlightenment as understood in Europe, which allowed for certain fixed truths, and therefore that in the United States, at least in the origins, there was an opportunity to avoid the kind of relativism and what he called nihilism that modern society tended to degenerate towards as all value neutrality became the dominant mode.
Mm-hmm. Go into that just a little bit more. Political science at the time was obsessed with, I guess, trying to measure things, trying to become a science.
Yeah, the behavioral revolution in political science. It was somewhat ironic that he wound up in a political science department teaching political philosophy. His early years, he spent a good deal of time and through his whole academic career attacking social science for its perceived value neutrality, and he argued instead that that political truths needed to be grounded in some I suppose you'd say some kind of absolute, or at least some kind of order. Now, I think really what he was doing in a way was taking American social science and subjecting that to critique rather than directly critiquing the kind of openness and predominant liberal orientation of American society as a whole.
We are speaking with Nicholas Kosenos, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation. If you'd like to join our conversation, it's 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're discussing the legacy of a political philosopher named Leo Strauss. Let's get a call from Steve, who's calling from Detroit.
Hi, yeah. In your introduction, and I don't know much about Strauss, there's an interesting connection between Strauss and sort of neoconservatives. And I think it's interesting that Strauss's universal values have been tied to that somehow, because it doesn't seem to be necessarily true that universals are necessarily conservative. So, for instance, it seems universally wrong that people anywhere in the world should be dying of AIDS or dying of starvation and so forth. I think it's an interesting leap to make.
Are those the kind of absolute or universal truths that Strauss was talking about?
No, I don't think he was talking about universal truths at all. The notion that there's a fixed sort of natural order, and that we derive our moral values from nature as opposed to convention, was important for Strauss. But he didn't think in terms of universal enlightenment type truths. And in fact, I think it's very complicated, hard to figure out exactly what these truths are that Strauss was talking about. They're very much grounded, I think, in the idea that philosophy is about the pursuit of those truths, not that one sort of necessarily finds or articulates them, but it's about the pursuit of them. And it's the pursuit of them that disrupts what are commonly held to be truths, the truths of popular opinion.
Thank you, Steve, for the phone call. How do we get from all of that to foreign policy?
Well, I don't know how you get there to foreign policy, but I think I know how you get there to the notion that foreign policy that is somehow related to Strauss. That is to say, this notion of the esoteric, exoteric language. Strauss was a very successful, very popular teacher in Chicago, venerated by his students. Around him developed something like a cult. Saul Bellow, in his novel Ravelstein, which was about one of Strauss's most prominent students, Alan Bloom, sort of described that kind of cult-like quality of a group of people bound together by this pursuit of higher knowledge, esoteric language, and all that sort of thing. And so when it was noticed that there were prominent Straussians in first the Reagan administration and then in the current administration, I think that led to the notion that there was something sinister going on, or there was a conspiracy or a small group somehow all interconnected. And so I think it may be the sort of sociology of the thing rather more than the content of what Straussians think that has been the source of concern.
Nicholas Kosenos, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Kosenos is a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and working on a book about Leo Strauss. He joined us from the studios of member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. When we come back from a short break, we'll talk with William Crystal, the editor of the Weekly Standard, who will be with us here in Studio 3A and take more of your calls about the legacy of Leo Strauss. Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about Leo Strauss, who he was, and how he has come to influence American politics. We also want to hear, of course, from you. If you're familiar with Strauss, what connection do you see between his philosophy and modern politics? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. As we mentioned, since the 1980s, some students of Strauss have been active in politics and the media. William Kristol, former aide to Vice President Dan Quayle, currently editor of the influential magazine The Weekly Standard, is one such. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thanks, Neil. Good to be with you.
When did you first become acquainted with the teachings of Leo Strauss?
I never actually met Leo Strauss. He died in 1973, I believe, and I was just beginning graduate school then, but I studied political philosophy as an undergraduate and a graduate student at Harvard, and Strauss was a well-known interpreter of texts, and one became familiar with him just in the course of one's studies. In particular, also, I had Harvey Mansfield of Harvard, who still teaches there, a very fine scholar, in his own right, maybe the most preeminent interpreter of Machiavelli, I would say, and alive today. And he had been a student of Strauss, or had read Strauss, and had been so convinced by Strauss's writings that he became a, quote, Straussian, even though he actually hadn't gone to Chicago and had never actually, I guess, taken courses with Strauss. So Mansfield was considered a Straussian, therefore I'm considered a Straussian, and we're all cheerful parts of the Straussian cabal now, I suppose.
I suppose. As I understand it, there are East Coast Straussians and West Coast Straussians.
Right, and Northern and Southern Straussians. It's become a little bit much. I mean, look, Strauss was a very serious thinker, and one of the good things about this whole controversy, which has many silly and some distasteful aspects, I would say, is if it leads more people to read Strauss and make up their own minds about whether he is or isn't a compelling and convincing interpreter of Plato and Aristotle and Aristophanes and Maimonides and Machiavelli and Hobbes. I mean, the range of his work was amazing, all the way up through Nietzsche very modern thinkers. If people should make up their own minds about him, you know, we shouldn't take it on authority that he was a great thinker or that he was wrong about things. Mm-hmm. And the other point I would make, just in an introductory way, is I've never said that my own political beliefs derive from Strauss, and there are Straussians who are liberals and conservatives, Straussians who opposed the intervention in Iraq, and Straussians who favored it. I mean, Strauss operated at a very high level of theory, really, and he wrote very little about American politics, almost nothing about American foreign policy, certainly. And those of us who happened to be hawks in the 90s and were for intervening in Bosnia and intervening in Kosovo and intervening in Iraq never said that's because we studied with a student of Strauss, and I don't think it is, in fact. I think there's a sort of weird, and I think Professor Kassenos suggested this too, there's a weird jump from Strauss's great influence as a thinker and teacher to the notion that a small group of us somehow have ever claimed that we were applying Strauss when we happen to, several of us happen to be, have fairly normal, if somewhat controversial, but I mean, you know, political views.
If there's a way that you could say that he has influenced your thinking, what would it be?
Well, it's a tough question because he has influenced it in so many ways, I think, but, you know, it's hard to disentangle them, and I don't want to claim Strauss's authority for anything I myself would say. One could have studied Strauss much more than I have and disagree with everything I'd say. I think the one thing that Strauss does is he makes one question a simple-minded belief in progress. Professor Cassandra's mentioned that. I mean, Strauss's thought led to a revival of serious interest in the ancient political thinkers, in medieval political thinkers like Maimonides, Al-Farabi, and others, and the notion that, you know, maybe they were right about some things. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were more right about some things than the modern thinkers whom earlier academics tended to say had obviously progressed beyond those earlier thinkers. So there's a slight conservative impulse, perhaps, that comes out of taking Strauss seriously, a little more suspicion about notions that everything is moving in a progressive direction, a great suspicion of utopianism, a great suspicion of the notion that politics can solve all human problems. One thing Strauss seems pretty clear about is that, you know, every political order has certain limits, prejudices, characteristics, and one shouldn't put all one's faith in politics. Mm-hmm. So I think in that respect, Strauss has a certain tendency towards a kind of moderate conservatism in one's general political attitudes.
You mentioned Machiavelli. There's an email question from Steve Howes in Anchorage, Alaska. Can you compare Strauss to Machiavelli? He writes, I think Machiavelli is far more influential in the modern conservative movement, which is first and foremost a political movement.
Well, Strauss wrote a great, great book on Machiavelli, Thoughts on Machiavelli. He's often taken as an enemy of Machiavelli, Strauss, though I think a careful reading of the book would show that he has huge respect for Machiavelli.
We're back into esoteric.
Well, I think it's not so clear what Machiavelli thought about a lot of things, and it's not so clear what Strauss ultimately thought about Machiavelli. This is way beyond my pay scale, as we say in Washington. You know, this is a very high-level debate, which I'm not able to engage in, Strauss versus Machiavelli. But, I mean, sometimes there is a kind of silly, you know, they take one quote out of context. Strauss says playfully at the beginning that Machiavelli is often thought to have been a teacher of evil. In fact, he spends 350 pages showing that that's an incredibly simple-minded view of Machiavelli. You don't spend 355 pages on someone who is just a teacher of 350, whatever it is, pages, on someone who's simply a teacher of evil. But that's sometimes taken as if Strauss opposed Machiavelli. Strauss's attitude towards America, he didn't write much about America, is not Machiavellian in the sense that he seems to have a genuine respect for America's constitutional government, for constitutional democracy as a decent kind of government in the modern world, certainly by comparison, as you said earlier in the show, with what he saw firsthand in Germany in the late 20s and 30s as a much more rickety democracy collapsed into dictatorship, certainly by comparison with communism, which he was well aware of in the late 40s and 50s. So I think he's pro sort of American democracy, not in a simple-minded or unthinking or dogmatic way, but I think he would have considered himself a friendly critic of American democracy.
Let's get another caller on the line, and Jeffrey's with us from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air, Jeffrey.
Okay, I was wondering if there's a perceived perversion of the Straussian ethic of moral realism in associating it or equivocating it with neoconservative, in that neoconservative policy seems to have a likeness but is more guising in a gossamer veil realpolitik or a more Bismarckian tradition in sort of moral universals. And so I was wondering if anyone is if there's been any popular identification of like a perversion of the Straussian tradition in associating with neoconservatism.
Bill Kristol?
Well, that charge is sometimes made, and I'm in favor of that charge insofar as it's an attempt to save Strauss from being identified with any particular political group. And certainly, I put out the Weekly Standard for 9 years. I don't think we've ever claimed that, you know, Leo Strauss informs our editorials on Iraq or on healthcare or on the Bush-Kerry campaign. So I think one should separate Strauss from politics. I agree with the caller on that. I would just make just two cautions. I mean, neoconservatism has many strands, but there are many neoconservatives who were not influenced by Strauss, read a little bit of him, didn't think much of it one way or the other. Certainly among the Iraq hawks, who I've personally published in the Weekly Standard. I happen to have studied with Harvey Mansfield, and I'm a Straussian. But I've got to say almost every other person we've published either hasn't been much influenced by Strauss. Some have never read Strauss. They're just foreign policy hawks who think, you know what, we got to change the Middle East and Saddam. We had reason to believe Saddam was in violation of the UN agreements and he had to be removed. Perfectly normal points of view, the kinds that are debated on NPR every day. So the notion that Strauss is needed to explain any of this, I think, is really a mistake. I would just also caution, I mean, it's not clear what Strauss thinks about, quote, moral universals or whatever. I mean, Strauss thought it was too simple. Let's put it this way. When freshmen come to college and they learn, hey, everything's relative, and they, oh, that's so clever, you know, and I can show you that people have believed different things at different times, Strauss cautioned against a sort of simple-minded embrace of that kind of relativism. But Strauss by no means is clear as to whether one can in politics have universal truths or what their status would be. So, I mean, I don't want to – it's people have too quickly said, well, Strauss believes in absolute truth and he hated relativism. I think he had a certain contempt for a very easygoing relativism that people come to and then don't have to answer any questions. You never have to think about anything. That's your opinion. That's my opinion. Who knows what's right or wrong? Strauss had a certain – thought that was just silly and a kind of – a problem for modern democracy that, you know, there's a certain temptation that way, and we've seen that a lot, I think, in our culture. But it's perfect. But it's not so clear what Strauss himself thought about whether individuals like us could sort of figure out absolute truths or apply them to politics. He was a little wary of that, I would say.
Jeffrey, thank you.
Thank you.
Bill Kristol is the co-author of an article on Strauss. You're turning that into a book,
right? My colleague Steve Lenzner and I have been asked by Oxford University Press to turn this into a book called The Problem of Leo Strauss. I guess there'll be a lot of books out on Strauss in the next year or two. There are one or two out already. And as I say, I think some of them are good. I'm sure will be better than others, and I hope there are some that are better than Steve Lenzer's and mine. But it's useful if it gets people to go back to the original source, to read Strauss, to read the writers Strauss is commenting on, and to think seriously about these problems. We're calling the book The Problem of Leo Strauss precisely to make the point that when you really read Strauss at all seriously, you see that there's no dogma there. There are no solutions, really, I wouldn't say, or recommendations exactly there, except to study these thinkers seriously. And that, in fact, what he raises is some very deep problems for people to think about.
Well, joining us now is Ann Norton, a political scientist at the University of Pennsylvania, who has a new book out called Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire, which takes issue with the neoconservative reading of Strauss. She's with us from the studios of member station WHYY in Philadelphia. And it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Now, I understand you were a student at the University of Chicago and were taught by many influential Straussians. Can you describe the intellectual climate at Chicago when you were there?
Oh, of course. It was a climate of great intellectual passion. It was a place, more than any place I've encountered since, where learning was genuinely valued and people were distinguished by having a kind of unappeasable appetite for learning. People had real intellectual passions. They acted on them all the time. The most exciting things to them were the things they learned.
Hmm. Now, at what point in your career did you, you studied with Strauss himself or with students of Strauss?
No, like Bill Kristol, I came to school at about the time Strauss died. I studied with a number of students of Strauss, Joseph Cropsey, Ralph Lerner, Leon Cass.
And did you make a distinction between what you came to learn later as the teaching of Strauss and Straussians?
Yes, definitely. I'd make several distinctions. I'd make a distinction between the teaching of Strauss, the teaching of the students of Strauss, the teaching of people who call themselves Straussians, and and of course, Straussian neoconservatism, which is a subset of that, of the latter.
Well, I guess those first two categories, is that an academic debate?
Strauss and the students of Strauss?
Yes.
Well, all students, I think everyone who teaches hopes that their students will add something to what they, what they've taken from the teacher. So it's certainly not surprising that Strauss's students both may not have gotten all that Strauss taught, but also may have brought, their own learning to that enterprise.
And, let's get on to the subject where I guess most of us are interested at this point, and that's the influence of the Straussian teachings on politics. Bill Kristol has told us that he thinks it doesn't have a direct impact. What do you think?
I agree completely with Bill Kristol on that. I think it's influence is always a combination of things, and Strauss is one strand. My sense from reading Strauss and reading Straussian neoconservatism is that there's a fairly significant gap, and that Straussian neoconservatives seem to me to be often more influenced by Strauss's student Alan Bloom and perhaps in some respects by Albert Wohlstetter, a teacher of international relations and national security at Chicago, and by other sources as well.
And Secretary Wolfowitz would say that he's a student of Wohlstetter rather than a student of Strauss.
Now, that's an academic distinction. he was certainly a student of both of those men. He wrote his dissertation, as I understand it, under Albert Wohlstetter, but he spent a good deal of his undergraduate life studying with Alan Bloom, who was, of course, a student of Strauss and a very influential Straussian, and someone who I think really left a mark on Straussian neoconservatism, an unfortunate mark, in my view. And so... to say he studied with Wohlstetter rather than Strauss is a little bit misleading, I think.
We're talking with Ann Norton and William Kristol. The subject is The Legacy of Leo Strauss. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And you said unfortunate. Why do you think unfortunate?
I think that Alan Bloom really cultivated a set of cultic behaviors among his students. I also think that Bloom encouraged certain mistakes, like identifying political moves in the United States that he regarded as unfortunate, with German thought, with forwarding a really facile view of moral relativism. I think that Bloom's sort of passionate hatred for American popular culture and his also equally passionate elitism, which comes out very clearly in The Closing of the American Mind.
That's his most famous book, of course, a bestseller.
Exactly. And, I mean, it was very popular. It was very influential. I think that it had, I mean, Bloom is really unhappy about the opening of the Academy to African Americans and to women, and he makes that very clear in The Closing of the American Mind, and I think that's one of its more unfortunate aspects.
Bill Kristol, let's get you back into the conversation here. Is this an argument about Leo Strauss or an argument about Alan Bloom?
Well, Alan Bloom isn't unfortunately here to defend himself. I think that's a very unfair, those are unfair and inaccurate statements about Bloom, who I didn't personally study with, though I knew slightly over the years. I hadn't studied at Cornell or Chicago or Toronto where Bloom taught. But anyway, I could. This isn't the place I'm supposed to debate Alan Bloom's thought. Look, I think in general it is a bad idea to these thinkers should be treated in their own, you know, should be judged in their own terms. If people think Alan Bloom's book, he certainly had plenty of people wrote critical reviews of The Closing of the American Mind, and we can debate whether his general analysis of the trend and tendency of modern thought was right or not. I think it's an awfully interesting book, and he did an awful lot of other important scholarly work. More scholarly work as well, and was apparently a magnificent teacher and deeply influenced lots of students. The idea that Paul Wolfowitz, I mean, Paul Wolfowitz wrote his thesis with Wallstetter. He was obviously influenced by Bloom. He was influenced by his father. He was influenced by lots of other academics. Paul Wolfowitz has lived in Washington, worked in, I guess, administration since the Carter administration. He has his own views about foreign policy. They're certainly legitimate to debate those. It's certainly legitimate to debate those views. They're fair game, to use a phrase that was used recently, for all critics of all kinds. The idea that he's channeling Alan Bloom or Leo Strauss is ridiculous, if anything. Ann Norton just said that Alan Bloom had a certain elitism, a certain contempt for democracy. Strauss himself has often been accused of being anti-democratic. What is the main charge against Paul Wolfowitz, or against me for that matter, insofar as I have a tiny role to play in this too? That we're overly enthusiastic about democracy, that we want to democratize the entire Middle East, we're utopian, we're Wilsonian, we're crazy, we don't understand that you can't democratize these whole parts of the world. So how is that consistent? I mean, Bloom is famously skeptical about democracy, and Wolfowitz is Mr. Democracy.
Ann Norton, we have to take a break in about a minute, but if you wanted to reply to that?
Oh, yes, of course. I think the main charge against Bill Kristol, if I may say so, is not democratizing the Middle East, but rather engaging in a crusade and neglecting what Strauss and indeed most Americans recognize, which is the importance of the consent of the governed.
Well, let's pause there and take a short break. And when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Bill Kristol, of the editor of the Weekly Standard, and Ann Norton, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. We welcome your contributions as well. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. We'll also be talking with NPR's Peter Kenyon in Jerusalem about the debate which opened today in Israel's Knesset about the future of disengagement, Prime Minister Sharon, and perhaps the future of Israel. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now we're talking about Leo Strauss, a man who is, some identify as the architect of American empire. Our guests are William Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, who's with us here in Studio 3A, and Ann Norton, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. totn@npr.org if you want to send a question by email. Let's get a caller on the line, and Chuck is calling from San Francisco.
Hi.
Hi.
I once read something about Strauss that suggested he was a big believer in democracy and spreading democracy to countries that didn't have it already, but that he was also a believer in democracy among countries. And I find it interesting that so many people who are usually considered disciples of Strauss also seem to have this hostility to international institutions like the UN, and especially given the comments lately about derisive comments about an international test and surrendering any sovereignty to international institutions. I wonder where this concept fits into the whole picture.
I think the phrase was global test, but
global test, whatever. You know what I mean.
Why don't we start with you, Bill Kristol?
I mean, Strauss wrote almost nothing about current issues of public policy or international politics. He seems to have been generally of a conservative bent, I think it's fair to say, and from a couple of little remarks, but these are now in introductions and sort of comments he made occasionally, sort of a believer in what we, I think, a sort of tough foreign policy, I think it's fair to say. He wasn't a big believer in, you know, world peace suddenly descending upon us and that dictatorships would decide to lie down with democracies and be and coexist peacefully and wonderfully. But really, there's a huge range of one could read Strauss and believe that the war in Iraq was a mistake. One could believe it was necessary. One could believe that the UN might be a useful institution. One could believe that it, on the whole, sometimes does more harm than good. So I want to make clear again that I don't think there's much Straussian sort of approval, let's say, or grant of legitimacy for any of this variety of views. And in particular, Strauss, again, I think Andor would agree with this. I mean, it's funny that people now think of him because of this attempt to identify Wolfowitz and some of the rest of us with him, which is not an attempt I've made or Wolfowitz has made, God knows, that Strauss is now some kind of believer in democracy, when, if anything, the charge against him among academics, I think equally misguided in certain respects, was that he was wildly anti-democratic, elitist, you know, that was sort of the conventional academic charge of those who disliked Strauss's work in the 50s and 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. So I think the truth is Strauss was a very interesting thinker, and the rest of us can debate whether the UN is a very useful institution or not.
Ann Norton?
I do agree with that, although there is actually a very interesting writing of Strauss's in which he talks about his fear of world government and his hostility to international institutions, something that he shared with the French philosopher Alexandre Kojève. And this is in his discussion of Xenophon's hero. And it's quite interesting because it owes a lot to another European thinker, Carl Schmitt. So there is something in Strauss that is, I mean, Strauss is quite open about his anxiety about international institutions, and that was something that was shared by a number of European thinkers in the 1930s mm-hmm. and later.
I'm sorry, Chuck, I couldn't hear you.
So democracy is good within countries but not among countries, which seems odd to me.
Well, let me just, I mean, that depends. Is it democracy within countries if dictatorships and democracies have the same vote, which, of course, is the case at the UN? Should China have a veto on human rights policies? Sudan, I believe, is on the Human Rights Commission. I think one can be pro-democracy and an attempt to foster democracy around the world and very skeptical that the UN, practically speaking, is A, either a very good embodiment of democracy, or B, does a lot to help democracies around the world.
And that is going to have to be the last thought because we want to move on. Chuck, thanks for the phone call. And we wanted to thank Ann Norton, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Her book is Leo Strauss and the Politics of American Empire. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Bill Kristol, the editor of the Weekly Standard and the author of a forthcoming book, The Problem of Leo Strauss. And he joined us here in Studio 3A. As always, Bill, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure, Neil.